91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour, we explore some of the latest medical technology and examine what may be on the horizon. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Talk about cutting edge. Robotic surgery can give more precision, flexibility, and control than conventional operations. It's usually associated with minimally invasive surgeries. We'll learn more about other medical advances your doctor may use with journalist Mark Bloom. He's been on the medical beat for more than 40 years. And we'll visit with two South Floridians who are innovative in the startup scene. They founded Modernizing Medicine. That's next, after NPR and regional news. And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. 7 minutes past 1 o'clock on this Monday afternoon. And we begin today's hour with longtime journalist and editor Mark Bloom. He's specialized in medical stories for the bulk of his career. He was editor-in-chief of Physicians Weekly, a founding editor of MedPage Today, and is now its editor emeritus.
He's versed in sports medicine, addiction medicine, oncology, cardiology, hypertension, and physician issues. Mark Bloom now joins us from Charleston, South Carolina. Welcome to you, Mark.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm here. I sound so impressive in your introduction. I almost didn't recognize myself.
And we didn't even mention yet that you covered the Beatles when they came.
I covered the Beatles.
And LBJ Scar.
I covered landing on the moon. I was in the right place at the right time for much of my career.
Well, let me ask you, as one who's covered many of the medical and scientific innovations of really the last half century, how is it possible for doctors to keep up with the pace of technology and innovation when they're being consumed with their practice?
Very difficult for doctors to even keep up with the scientific elements of their practice, much less the technology that's being thrown at them, and most of them probably don't keep up.
Well, how would you assess the innovations in progress? How many years does it take to find out if something promising was successful versus just a lot of hype?
Well, I'll just give you an example. In today's paper, and probably on your news broadcast, there was a study that was halted about the so-called good cholesterol. As I'm sure you all know, a number of years ago, the bad cholesterol, the LDLs, led to statins, which have been a major advance in cardiology over the years, but at the same time, there was an effort to reduce the LDLs. At the same time, there was an effort to increase the good cholesterol, the HDLs. If you can reduce the bad and increase the good, everything will be much better, presumably. But today, a major trial was halted for a drug to boost the so-called good cholesterol, which suggests that maybe all these, for several years, for 10 years or so, the increasing the so-called good cholesterol really doesn't work. So that's an example of something that people have been have been accepting as an article of faith for a decade that may be wrong.
Mark Bloom, journalist and editor, with so many infrequent changes in medicine, how does a reporter like yourself or an editor separate the hype from real progress?
Well, basically, I've been editor and reporter for half a century, and I learned early on that when I was working for the New York Daily News, I kept writing the phrase, if the promise holds. And that was particularly for cancer. And then I realized, after a year of writing that, that the promise never seemed to hold. So something switched off in my brain as a reporter, and I started thinking that perhaps most of what I was writing about really was not very important and not correct. So I now look for what is bad rather than what is good when I'm presented with a press release, for instance.
What do you mean? You look at what the risks or negative thing, the negative aspects of it would be rather than what it could do?
If I get a press release from a company, no matter what the company is, a technology company, a medical technology company, or a pharmaceutical company, or what have you, I realize that they're presenting the best possible case in their press release. They're certainly not going to tell me what's wrong with what they're doing. And frequently there is something wrong with what they are doing. So my original, I read it and I pretty much ignore what the good is and I say, what's wrong here?
Mark Bloom, when you go to personally to a new doctor's office, what do you look for?
It's one of the most difficult decisions that any citizen will make. How do you choose a physician? How do you choose a personal physician? I was very fortunate when I had a heart attack over 20 years ago that I went to Mount Sinai Hospital and I became a patient of the chairman of cardiology there, a man named Valentin Pfister. And he pointed me in the right directions for an internist, for an endocrinologist, for whatever I needed. So I was lucky. Most people don't have a good guide to a personal physician. If you look on the internet, you're only going to see the good. You're not going to see the bad. So it's a very, very difficult decision. And I really don't have an answer for how you choose a doctor.
Well, sometimes, actually, when you look on the internet, you can see the bad, but it could be a disgruntled patient. You can report on doctors now. And sometimes that isn't accurate either when it's bad. So,
That's correct. As I say, it's very difficult for anyone to choose a physician, because I defy you to find a physician who says he's not a good physician.
Certainly, you've covered the impact of the Affordable Care Act in your reporting. How would you assess its efficacy?
Well, the Affordable Care Act came along toward the end of my active career. I've certainly followed it. And it appears to be proving itself to be a very worthy endeavor. Many people have health insurance who didn't have health insurance before. You have to remember that when I started covering medicine, people didn't even know how many chromosomes there were in a genome. There was no NPR to help them along. It's a long time ago. The Affordable Care Act, to me, is nothing but positive.
Mark Bloom, in your long career, do you find that care has been better or worsened over the decades that you've been involved?
I don't think it's been worsened. I'm not quite sure it's been improved. There are things that have come along in medicine, particularly in cardiology, such as statins, to lower the bad cholesterol, the so-called bad cholesterol. And there have been improvements in breast cancer. When I first started covering medicine, breast cancer was a death sentence. It is no longer that for most women. The same is true for prostate cancer in men. There has been a slow, steady, incremental improvement. one particular cancer, CML, a drug called Gleevec has pretty much turned it from a death sentence into a condition that can be managed, much like HIV. HIV was new; it was midway in my career. There was no such a thing as HIV, and it too was a death sentence early on when people were treating it, and it too has become a manageable disease. And that's for the good. I don't think things have worsened. I just don't think things have improved as much as people would have you believe.
What do you think are the greatest challenges facing physicians today?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess it's trying to keep up with what was going on. And for much of my career, the last three decades, I was the editor of publications that covered medical news for them, mm-hmm. as opposed to for lay people. So that's what we tried to do. We tried to do to cover medicine that would help doctors keep up. Very, very difficult. Some people say that a doctor does not begin improving after he finishes his residency. That's as smart as he's ever going to get. I don't know if that's true, but that's a cliche these days in medical education.
Well, journalist and editor Mark Bloom joining us on the program today. Mark, we want you to stay with us. We're going to take a break. When we come back with another segment, we'd like you to remain with us. This is Topical Currents.
Welcome back to Monday's Topical Currents, Bonnie Berman and Joseph Cooper. We continue with Mark Bloom's dog.
Is this the veterinarian at your service program?
We continue with medical journalist and editor Mark Bloom. But we also add two guests. We'll learn more about how the business of medical innovation is accomplished with Dr. Michael Sherling. He's the co-founder and chief medical officer of Modernizing Medicine. The firm specializes in electronic medical assistance, or EMAs, which we'll be referring to quite a bit.
And he's a practicing dermatologist based in Palm Beach County. Welcome to you, Dr. Sherling.
Thanks so much for having me here.
Also in the studio is Modernizing Medicine's CEO and co-founder, Daniel Kane. He's helped raise over $49 million for the firm, which employs some 300 employees.
We'll now learn more about how the firm works. Welcome to you, Daniel.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
It's our pleasure. Okay, how, why, when did this partnership, you, Daniel Kane, an entrepreneur, and Dr. Michael Sherling, a dermatologist, you teamed up, you started this, give us how it happened.
Sure. So I've always been a bit of a tech entrepreneur. And when I moved back to South Florida a little over 5 years ago, I was driving my wife and kids a bit crazy, and she encouraged me to get out there. But before I did so, her one condition, or one demand, if you will, was that I get a checkup. So I did that. And being unemployed and a recent retransplant back to South Florida, I was quite tan. And so they referred me to a dermatologist, which happened to be Michael right here. And it was in that process that I realized that there was still a lot of work to do in healthcare, that technology hadn't really made its way in appropriately to the medical practice, and that they weren't using technology efficiently, certainly in Michael's practice. And as I learned very quickly, throughout a lot of healthcare, there's certainly a lot of healthcare technology in general. But the private practice physician was really struggling with the tools that were provided to them.
Like what? What do you mean?
Well, for instance, when I met Michael, his practice was very much paper-based. And it wasn't that Michael is a Luddite by any means. He graduated college about the same time I did, and so, you know, was very comfortable with technology, but very correctly made the decision that for his high-volume practice, technology would slow him down, and more importantly, it wouldn't make him a better physician, that he would be just fine with paper, And I know that there are a lot of physicians out there that feel the same way, that the wrong technology is a big step backwards. Sure, you go from analog to digital. You've got things as ones and zeros. But doctors are really lousy typists. They're not efficient. It takes away from this patient experience. For anyone who's been to a doctor in the last 5 years who's using an electronic health record, chances are that they're turning their back on the patient. They're typing at a keyboard. It's a very, you know, impersonal experience where they're spending more time in front of the computer than in front of the patient. And so Michael very correctly realized that although he had used them in his training and in his residency, that these were not good tools for him. And we struck up a conversation because it was actually his medical assistant that noted that I was a software entrepreneur and wanted to learn more about sort of where I had come from and how I got there. And that conversation segued into technology and healthcare, of which I didn't have much of a background, but I'm one of these people that walks into a room and I immediately size up 10 ways technology can be used to, you know, improve efficiency or in this case, improve healthcare.
Okay, Dr. Sherling, Michael?
Yes.
Your and for you, what was it about Daniel?
Absolutely. You know, I see patients every day, and on his without breaking HIPAA or anything like that, on his intake sheet, he put that he was a software entrepreneur. And I really was interested, always intrigued about, you know, what they do. My medical assistant had founded that, you know, he had founded a company called Blackboard, and he grew that company to over $1 billion. And so here was my chance to modernize healthcare. And I had this vision of saving physicians time, but also making them better and more effective. And the real barrier to medical innovation is that all of our observations are trapped in these silos, whether that's a paper chart or whether that's an electronic health record that's just capturing narrative. And instead, it's slowing us down, and instead we could create and capture structured information, how patients are doing, whether they're getting better or they're getting worse, and save me time using something that's mobile, something that's cloud, something that's going to make me fast.
Give us an example of, say, a fictitious patient, how this will save you so much time and give you more insight as far as the patient.
And help the patient more.
You got it. So a patient may come in with a condition, let's say they have acne or psoriasis, they come and see me. And typically, like Daniel was saying, your back is turned away from the patient. I've become a data entry specialist with another system. I'm typing and I'm disconnected from my patient. With this, because it's mobile, I'm sharing that those observations with my patient. Emma is a very visual application. So
Emma, again, let's just give, it's an acronym for electronic medical assistant.
Okay. Absolutely. And so we have this native iPad application called Emma, that you can see visually the anatomy of the patient, and I'm sharing that with my patient. And I can diagnose visually where they have their acne, where they have their psoriasis, and I can rate that patient's condition, the severity of their illness, and they can rate the severity of their illness. So when I give an intervention, whether that's a prescription or a different type of treatment, we can see together if they get better or they get worse.
How are they seeing it?
Yeah.
They can see it because we have this way of capturing how they improve, called Emma outcomes. And so we rate their condition on a scale of 1 to 5. And these are validated, accepted scales that are used by academic medical centers in their publications. And with treatment, we can see if they get from a 5, which is really severe, to a 2 or to a 1.
Okay, would you explain, I come into your office with psoriasis, mm-hmm. let's say. You look at it. Mm-hmm. Tell me how this Emma works. I don't
Absolutely.
Really understand.
Yeah, it's very similar to, it's almost akin to going to a fast food market where you go up and you're ordering an entree and you say, okay, I want X, Y, and Z. And the cashier will just touch X, Y, and Z. It's very simple. It's a little bit more complicated with medicine, but Dan and I have created this medical knowledge where we literally relate diagnoses, exam findings, interventions, and design it into touch, so it's all connected. So I would literally just touch psoriasis. You have erythematous plaques that are scaly on extensor surfaces, touch. They are on this body location, touch. And then I'll click prescription, and it has adaptive learning so that all my most common prescriptions rise to the top, so it's right at my fingertips. And then the most important part, the part that really helps medicine, is where the patient is at that time. Is their condition severe? Is their condition mild? And I'll touch that. they'll come in again, and then I can see if that treatment actually worked or it didn't work. And then I can consume that and share that with the patient, and we can learn together whether we were effective or not.
Now, we've only talked about this for an example in dermatology, but you have other specialties also, correct?
Excuse me. Yeah, we absolutely do. We decided to be a very focused organization and focusing on specific both medical and, more importantly, surgical specialties that were what we viewed as grossly underserved. And, you know, there was this notion, which is false, that one size could fit all in healthcare. One software package would work fine for an orthopedic surgeon or a dermatologist and be the same system that an internist uses or, you know, a podiatrist uses, and that we could literally have one system for all. And that just isn't the case. And so we focus very much on surgical specialties, dermatology, ophthalmology, orthopedics. We have 8 specialties in total. And the application we've built, this electronic medical assistant, is very unique for each one. So as Michael, who's a dermatologist, is using the iPad, he's seeing a visualization of the patient's skin, and he's touching on locations on their external anatomy, and he's documenting their conditions, again, using touch. Whereas our rheumatologist might touch on which joints are affected or inflamed, or our orthopedic surgeon might touch on, you know, not even just a specific bone, but, you know, fractures occur in very specific patterns in very specific locations. And so, again, they're using touch to document their entire narrative. And from that touch, a few things happen. Most importantly, the note gets captured in a very structured way, including these outcomes. But also, we just entered last week into the realm of ICD-10.
And now, what is that?
So that is a very fancy way of saying how we code, right? So we used to keep track of things using not so fancy ICD-9, and now we're at 10. But it was a way for physicians and billers in the entire system to capture what the disease was. And then typically there was enough specificity in that code to figure out potentially a classification of disease or where it is on the body. But, you know, think about it as, you know, a UPC symbol that would be on a grocery in the grocery store. And what has changed is we've gone from a system where we were using 3 digits, sometimes 4 digits of code, and doctors could remember their 100 most common, you know, diagnoses they made. And now we're in a world where these are now 7 characters long. They're both alphabetic and numeric. And we're expecting physicians to memorize thousands of them because the level of specificity has gone up tremendously. And in truth, when the government encouraged the system to take this on, they viewed it as a barcode, a serial code. No one goes into, you know, Publix and memorizes the difference between a Honeycrisp and a Golden Delicious apple. They just ring it up and the computers know how to do it, and it knows what to charge, and everything happens beautifully. Healthcare should be the same thing. The system should be able to handle all of this ICD-10 code for them, yet we've somehow shifted the burden to the providers to have to memorize these codes, and it's just a tremendous burden for them that they shouldn't have to do, and our users don't have to understand that. Again, it's that combination of touch the disease, as Michael said, touch, you know, the severity, touch where it is on the body or the bone or the joint or whatever it might be, and the system can create that ICD-10 code.
This may sound... I'll get to you, Bonnie. Okay. This may sound very mundane. What does it do for wait times in offices?
So
is there a realistic decrease in
absolutely.
Wait times?
I mean, the reason this little software company called Modernizing Medicine has grown so quickly, I'd love to tell you it's because that someday we're going to be able to actually show what works and what doesn't in healthcare for a certain type of patient. And our goal, really, to claim the name of Modernizing Medicine is all about improving patient outcomes. But in truth, the hyper growth has been because we drive efficiency in practice. And it's that shaving a minute or two per patient off of their documentation burden times 40, 50, 60 patients that a provider might see in a day. That's 2 hours of their time back. And typically what they're doing is they're spending more time with their patients, they're having a better patient experience, but they're also leaving clinic at 5:30 after their last patient is seen and not staying for 2 or 3 hours after clinic to catch up on their documentation. And so it's that driving efficiency that has enabled the growth of the company.
I just want to ask, given that it's cloud-based and electronic, is there more of a risk of a breach of privacy for the patient?
Oh, there's far less risk, in my opinion. I mean,
why?
Most providers wouldn't have a team of security experts, for example, constantly looking at and protecting their data. If you think about a client-server application, it's stored in the closet under a desk somewhere, and that is, you know, no more secure than a paper chart was before, right? Someone could easily come in, and hopefully they've taken good security measures. But the cloud offers us tremendous reliability and security. I have a team of people that's their entire job is to make sure that data is secured. It's encrypted not only when it's in motion, which is what people are concerned about. If someone loses the iPad, has any data been lost? The answer is absolutely not. But also, it needs to be secured at rest. So when that data is sitting in the cloud, at no point is it ever not encrypted. The only time it's ever available is when a provider is looking at it on their iPad. They set the iPad down. As soon as it goes to sleep, powers off, they turn it off. That information was never actually stored on there. It only was in the cloud.
Mm. We're speaking with Dr. Michael Sherling and Daniel Kane. They're co-founders of Modernizing Medicine. Dr. Sherling is a dermatologist, and Daniel Kane's an entrepreneur. We're going to take a short break. We also have Mark Bloom with us. He's a reporter and editor specializing in science and medicine, and we'll hear from him when we come back on Topical Currents. And we're back with today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we're speaking about modern medicine with Mark Bloom. He's a reporter and editor specializing in science and medicine. Daniel Kane, an entrepreneur and the CEO and co-founder of Modernizing Medicine, which is a company, with Dr. Michael Sherling, who's a dermatologist and the other co-founder and chief medical officer of Modernizing Medicine. If you'd like to join in the conversation, if you have questions or are confused about anything you're hearing, you can call us 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Email is radio@wlrn.org. Perhaps you're a patient of Dr. Sherling and you do know how it works.
Journalist and editor Mark Bloom, you've been listening to the previous segment. Any comments on what you've heard?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. When people used to ask me what was the difference between writing for medicine for physicians and writing medicine for lay people, I used to use the example of Medicare. And for the layperson, Medicare is an entitlement program for people 65 years old and older. And for physicians, Medicare is a story about a significant chunk of their income. So I'm listening to coding, and when over the years when I heard about coding, whenever I wrote about coding, I always thought of it as something that the physicians use not so much for diagnosis, but as a diagnostic tool for billing. Am I crazy?
Okay, who's going to take that?
I can take that one. No, not at all. I mean, we use ICD-10 for coding and billing, but the underlying intent is to break down diagnoses to make them more specific. And there are a lot of academic institutions and research organizations that would like to use those more specific codes for more research and medical innovation. And I think that is the intent.
Well, yes, but the coding comes from the American Medical Association, and it's always a great debate at their annual meetings about upcoding and I didn't hear anything about how you determine on the basis of coding what to bill, for instance, Medicare, or what to bill the health insurance companies. Isn't that what coding is all about?
It is, and our system definitely keeps track of that, collects all of that information to determine the medical decision-making for doctors to figure out how that gets reimbursed. as well as the medical innovation part to figure out how to make patients better.
The pain point, Mark, that we're trying to address is that knowing, you know, rattling off these seven, you know, alphanumeric digits that are counting for exactly like you said, for billing purposes, for documentation purposes, doesn't make someone a better provider at all. And what we have done, unfortunately, by placing more and more technology in really by force into the hands of these doctors is we're not necessarily making them better physicians. We're just increasing the burden, in this case, the documentation burden of their billing to be able to justify a code. In truth, what we want are physicians that are practicing medicine, and the documentation should be a reflection of what they've done, and the bill should be no more nor less than what they've actually performed. And so, you know, we want to take these burdens, this you know, documentation burden, the coding burden, the analytics burden of measuring success off of the physician. Let them practice medicine. Let the computers do what they're good at, which is bean counting, which is accounting for what they've done. Let it handle the automation of billing. And let's not have our doctors constantly have to worry about, you know, thinking about the right charge for something. They should just practice medicine, focus on patient care, let the systems take care of the billing for them.
Well, in my experience, that's what doctors do constantly, is worry about what to charge for something. I'm not suggesting that physicians are not trying to help their patients. They are. The Affordable Care Act that we talked about earlier, one of the goals, as I recall, was to have computers speak to computers, so that if you go to a dermatologist, for instance, and then you go to an internist, and then you go to a surgeon, you don't have to fill out all the paperwork over and over and over again. It's done once, and it goes... it follows you along. Now, your system doesn't do that, does it?
Well, our system certainly is compatible with the latest government standards for what's called interoperability, which is just a fancy way of saying, can our system talk with other medical systems? And the answer is absolutely, and we are certified for that. You know, the hardest part about standardization in healthcare is the fact that, you know, medicine is awfully complex. And so, you know, it's one thing for systems to be able to talk about, you know, medications and allergies and lab results, and all systems are fairly good at communicating that information back and forth. But where we're falling down as an industry is with a lack of standardization on interoperability, on content liquidity, which is, again, another fancy way of saying content should move from one system to another and really follow the patient. And that's what's in the best interest of the patients. And so,
but that doesn't happen.
Well, it needs to happen more. I think, you know, we have the benefit of being cloud, so it's easier for us to talk to anyone because we're available with a browser or with a smartphone. I think that most systems today are client-server. I know that for a fact they are client-server, and it's much harder for a client-server system sitting under the desk of a practice to communicate with other systems.
I did some work with the American College of Pathologists a year or two ago, and one of their complaints was that vendors don't speak to vendors. And so that if a hospital spends a great deal of money putting in a new system to deal with computers, it doesn't help if a patient changes hospitals or changes surgeons or that the pathology doesn't move from place to place. And that was also true what's the term I'm looking for, when you're trying to send photographs from, such as your dermatological photographs, to another dermatologist for a second opinion. It's very difficult to do. And it's very difficult for the pathologist to send their slides to another pathologist for a second of opinion because of the vendor difficulties. Or am I oversimplifying?
No, I think you've nailed it. It is a challenge incumbent on the industry. I think it's really important for physicians and hospitals, when they're making vendor selection, to really understand interoperability. Can that system communicate with others? You mentioned pathology. It's one of our points of pride. Obviously, there's a lot of biopsying in dermatology. I think we do an exceptional job of not only making that open, but making it electronic so that our pathologists have the benefit of seeing the notes, seeing photos, getting information, so that they're able to make a better diagnosis than just having a slide in front of them. And so I think some vendors are certainly better than others. I think it's incumbent on the industry to really police itself. And if that doesn't work, to have governments and others really come in and step in to do the work that the vendors were unable to do and really crack open interoperability. Because at the end of the day, it's in the patient's best interest to have that provider have access to the information that's been taken in the past.
Okay. And at that point, we're going to have to put a period. Daniel Kane, entrepreneur, CEO, co-founder of Modernizing Medicine. We're also with Dr. Michael Sherling, the other co-founder and a dermatologist and chief medical officer of Modernizing Medicine. And we were just hearing from Mark Bloom, a reporter and editor specializing in science and medicine. Our last break, and we'll be right back. And
we return. We're back. It's today's topical currents. We're speaking about medical technology and research program, and we're going to be discussing a fascinating realm, which is robotic surgery, in just a moment. But we have a little bit more to talk with the doctor.
With Modernizing Medicine. Right. We wanted to ask about this telemedicine. It's an app.
Absolutely.
And how does it work?
Telemedicine is a new way of seeing patients and physicians interacting. Instead of interacting in person, we interact electronically. And the way that happens is that patients can take a picture of their rash or their condition using their smartphone that can then be sent securely to the physician. And in asynchronously or synchronously, it can be looked at by the physician, and then they can get a diagnosis without having to come into the office.
Okay, so I see how that saves the physician time, and I also read it adds a new revenue stream. But I don't understand when you say it reduces risks for the patient. How does it reduce risks for the patient?
Absolutely. So when a patient has a symptom, that may not happen during normal business hours. They could get a rash on the weekend or a symptom at night, and they may then have to call in to get an appointment, and that appointment can be 3 months from now.
I see.
And so then the patient then comes in, waits an hour in my waiting room, then gets to see me, and by that time the symptom's gone away, and all I can offer them is to come back for an in-person visit. Telemedicine changes that completely.
So are you available on the weekends with that and it's, after hours?
Absolutely. It's whenever the patient has that condition. And we have certain terms and conditions that, you know, I can then, you know, follow up with them within a 24-hour period. But the 24-hour period is much better than 3 months. And by that time, I can address the rash when it happens. I can give them a treatment that's appropriate for that condition. And of course, if there's anything that is troublesome to the patient or if I don't feel comfortable, I can always escalate that to an in-person visit.
So say they see something on them and they think, oh, this might be cancerous or might need a biopsy or whatever. And you look at it through the telemedicine, and you say, oh, no, it looks okay to me. And it turns out that it's more than that. How do you work with something like
that? Absolutely. And I think the key for telemedicine to be successful is you need to have that doctor-patient relationship so that it isn't just this one interaction that's electronic and there's no more follow-up. But we always ask whether the patient's seen in the office or electronically, that they always follow up. If that lesion doesn't go away, please come back and see me again. And so if you have that relationship and this system, this telemedicine offering that we have completely connects to our electronic health record, things like that won't happen.
Well, we've been speaking with the co-founders of Modernizing Medicine based in Palm Beach County. We've been speaking with Dr. Michael Sherling and also with the Modernizing Medicine CEO and co-founder, Daniel Kane. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And now we turn to a fascinating realm, robotic surgery. With us now by phone is Dr. Brian Slomovitz, a specialist in the field. He's the director of the Division of Gynecological Oncology in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the UM Miller School of Medicine. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on today.
Doctor, your main interest is applying principles from the lab to clinical settings in robotic surgery. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so first of all, you know, when we talk about robotic surgery, we're bringing in a new technology that allows us to do the same thing for patients as we used to do with these with big incisions. So the purpose of robotic surgery is to minimize the side effects for patients without losing any of the efficacy or the purpose of the surgery. You know, when we employ robotic surgery, it's very, very important to make sure that we can do that for the patient, because patients only have their surgery once. They only have their colon removed once, or they're only having their one hysterectomy, or they're only having their one prostatectomy. So it's important that when we do those surgeries that we do the right surgery, and we make sure we don't lose anything with the with the robot. One of the nice things that we're doing is that we're doing research now preclinically to make sure that the one-time surgery for the patients is successful.
When did you turn to robotic surgery?
Oh gosh, I've started doing robotic surgery in about 10 years ago. I originally was trained in laparoscopic surgery, mm-hmm. and laparoscopic surgery, a new name for that is what's called straight stick surgery. So it allows you to do minimally invasive surgery, but it doesn't give you as good visualization. It doesn't give you the wrist flexibility. You can't do as much laparoscopically as you can do robotically. So as soon as I implemented robotics into my practice about 10 years ago, we've been able to do much more radical technical procedures for our patients, again, without the prolonged hospitalization, the blood loss, the postoperative pain that they would suffer from after the same surgery is being done open.
What is robotic surgery best suited for, and what surgeries is it least suitable?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one of the things that we here at the university and in Sylvester Cancer Center and also in the community setting is being done is we always try to push the envelope, and we want to see how much we can do for the patients robotically without minimizing it. I would say that in general, robotics is very good when we're dealing with surgery in one part of the body. Perfect examples of that is when we're doing a hysterectomy for either a cancerous, a precancerous, or a diseased problem that a woman has in the female genital tract. Another perfect example is robotic prostatectomies for prostate cancer. That's been very well received, and our urology group here at the university is doing more procedures than anywhere else in the area.
Let me just ask how this works. Where are you? Where's the robot? And who's in the operating room?
That's a great question. And as soon as we say robotic surgery, immediately everyone starts thinking of R2-D2 and C-3PO and,
right.
You know, what's going on. And I can
and
tell
Da Vinci.
You, and, right. So we're using something called a Da Vinci robot. And the Da Vinci robot is made up of three components. One component is sort of the central core, and that's where all the computer processing is. That's where the... there is a screen there for people who aren't for the non-surgeon, not the operating surgeon, but it's really the heart of the machine, what that can help to connect the patient consult to the surgeon's consult. The patient's consult is made up of four arms, and it is attached to the patient through something called trocars, or instruments that require about a 1 centimeter incision in order to be in order for instruments to pass. And the third component is a surgeon's consult, where the surgeon sits, and it's sort of like a surgical module where the surgeon sits. They use two arms and two legs to operate the machine and move it around. In the robot's not doing anything by itself. In the robot technology world, it's something called a master-slave relationship, in that the robot only does what the surgeon tells it to do.
Okay, but it's a computer, so can it falter?
The robot can only falter if, you know, not it can't do anything that it's not told to do. Have I sat on a robot in a thunderstorm and the power goes out? It goes out for a second and then the hospital generators kick in. So it doesn't, you know, in the sense of can it do something that it's not told to do? No. Can it get out of control and start doing some surgery you don't want to? If the surgeon lifts his or her head out of the consult, the robot turns off automatically. So it cannot do anything on its own.
With so much emphasis I guess, of surgeons, budding surgeons, to do this sort of surgery. Does it at all make their other skills lackluster or not as accomplished?
Yeah, that's actually a great point. You know, the bread and butter of surgery, when we were brought up and we were taught the basics of surgery, was through open surgery. One of the challenges that we have now, not only operating on our patients, but as being a teaching professor in the institution, is we have to teach our younger surgeons how to operate. We do that in a lot of different ways, and actually in more effective ways than we had prior to the implementation of robots. We have surgical consults and modulators that are all done in the preclinical or in the laboratory setting, where resident physicians, medical students can sit and learn how to do the different procedures before they're actually touching a patient. So these are robotic simulators, they're called. And actually, not only are we using them to learn the skills, but we're doing research using the simulators in order to best determine the right way to do robotic surgery and to minimize pain, discomfort, blood loss, and the like.
Well, you're speaking a lot about the benefits of robotic surgery. What are the risks?
Yeah, that's a great question. And anytime there's new technology and new implementation, one of the downsides that a lot of the people come out with automatically is the cost. You know,
is it covered by insurance?
So, great question. Doing for example, a procedure, whether it be a hysterectomy, a prostatectomy, the insurance companies pay for the procedure, whether you're using a robot or laparoscopic or open. Oftentimes, the robot is covered. So I've never had a case that I could do robotically or laparoscopically. I've never had an insurance company tell me, oh, you can't do it robotically, but you can do it laparoscopically. So the answer is, yes, it is covered by insurance. One downside is, a learning curve. The most important two questions I tell patients to ask when they're about to have robotic surgery is to ask their surgeons, number one, how many of them have they done? And number two, what's their conversion rate? Or when they start robotically, how often do they need to convert to an open procedure? Obviously you want a surgeon to have done a lot of these procedures. And secondly, if they've never converted to an open, oftentimes, I wonder about the surgeon. It's okay to have to open to have a percentage of your cases to need to convert to an open procedure. You just don't want that number to be too high.
We're almost to the end of the program, but we do have an emailer, Marianne, who says she had a robotic hip replacement after being sold on its great precision. She wound up with a damaged nerve, the operated leg a half inch shorter than the other, and the person who had referred to her to the surgeon also has a shorter leg on the operated side. The scars 2 or 3 times longer than anterior hip surgery. She couldn't walk for 2 weeks afterwards, and she would not recommend hip replacement robotic surgery, and hers was not covered by the insurance.
Yep, so a couple things there. I did go through a couple surgeries that I'm comfortable in recommending to family and friends. Hip surgery was not one of them.
Okay.
But also, most importantly, it's out of my area of expertise, so I want to be, I'm not sure about the latest technologies in hip surgery. It does, if it was a family member of mine, I probably would have them do a regular hip replacement, not the robotic procedure. But also, that said, complications happen. If a surgeon tells you that he or she doesn't have complications, he or she is either lying to you or they don't operate enough. Medicine's an area of gray. It's not an area of black and white.
Well, thank you for addressing that. I wish we had longer. Dr. Brian Slomovitz is the Director of Division of Gynecological Oncology in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the UM Miller School of Medicine, and also the co-leader of the Gynecological Cancer Site Disease Group at Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center. We appreciate your being with us. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Again, thanks, guys, for having me on.
And thanks to Mark Bloom, journalist and longtime editor, for joining us.
Thank you, Mark. Wish we had longer.
I do, too.
Okay.
And that wraps up this edition. It was produced by Polly Landis with technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Additional assistance from lead producer Richard Ives. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. And more information, including links and photos, at the Topical Currents Facebook page. And join us for Must Hear tomorrow. We'll get the lowdown on the sometimes nefarious debt broker industry. Journalist Jake Halpern has penned Bad Paper, Chasing Debt from Wall Street to the Underworld. there's $831 billion in unpaid consumer debt in the U.S. Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.